So the United States is hammering Iran once again, and Mr. Trump wants to charge from now on for the use of the Strait of Hormuz. There's a problem. Iran is doing the same thing. This is crazy. Here's what you need to know about today.
The best analogy for a VC guy is that they're gamblers. And some of them will even outright say that. You know, these guys are, they're making bets, though. You know, you call it gambling, call it whatever you want.
For these war. They're betting on war.
They're betting on war.
And that's how they make their money. And they always seem to win. I wonder how. I'm going to show you how. Also, a special guest who is 100% behind Mr. Trump and 100% behind the war in Iran. To say the very least, I will likely disagree with him. All this on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hey there, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I am excited to tell you that later on in this program, I'm going to be sitting down with a U.S. Navy captain who is now running for Congress. He's in California. His views on Iran are diametrically opposed to my views. Let's just say we see things differently. And that's okay. That's okay, because different people are allowed to believe in different things. That's what we're all about here. In fact, I'm looking forward to the interview. I think you'll like it. So, President Trump said that he was going to hit Iran, and that's exactly what he is doing as we speak. But as you might expect, Iran is not sitting there and taking it. They're hitting back. So here's some of the latest images that we can show you that we have been collecting, different images of the United States as they hit the different targets in Iran. This is the third night, by the way, or the third straight night, that we should say, of Iran getting hit by the United States. This is hours after President Trump said that he's going to restart the naval blockade of Iranian ports. And he's also going to take control of the Strait of Hormuz. And he said that he is now going to be charging fees for ships to go in and out of the waterway. He says he's going to charge 20%. Not sure where that number came from. And the Iranians today have been making fun of it, as a matter of fact. Meanwhile, the Iranians are also saying that they're going to hit as well, hit back. And they've already targeted some of the tankers that are going through the Strait of Hormuz, with permission from Mr. Trump and the United States, but not with permission from them. So what they're arguing is that you can't do it without the permission of the Persians if you want to enter the Persian Gulf. Get it? So the Iranians have also been hitting targets in two places in particular, in a lot of places, but these two in particular that we've noticed, Bahrain and Jordan. And these are the two where a lot of obviously, a lot of U.S. facilities are located. And they've been getting hit hard, by the way. It's like back to the beginning, where we were like 4 months ago. Strait of Hormuz itself is effectively blocked right now. And you could expect two things to happen as a result of that. Expect that the price of oil is going to go up. I checked just before I came out on the air. It has already. It's risen about, I saw $8, $9, $10, depending on when you look. So it's up. Also expect that the oil and gas shortage around the world is going to be a big problem. It's going to worsen for countries as they try to brace for what could be, at least according to the economists that I have spoken to, people who I have sourced. They're saying, you know, in certain places like Southeast Asia, Thailand, for example, where it's hard to get the fuels, it could be an economic disaster. President Trump, meanwhile, sees this as an opportunity to be able to make more money, because he says if the Iranians can do this, if they can charge for entry into the Strait of Hormuz, then so can he.
The Hormuz Strait is open and will remain open with or without Iran. We are reinstating the Iranian blockade, so named because it is only stopping Iran ships or customers from entering or leaving. All other countries will have fair and open use of the strait. The USA will be, from this point forward, known as the guardian of the Hormuz Strait. But as such, and as a matter of fairness, will be reimbursed at the rate of 20% on all cargo shipped for any and all costs necessary to do the job of providing safety and security to this very volatile section of the world. The process and formation will begin immediately.
So here we are once again with the back and forths, and we're right in the thick of the war again. How do we get into this situation? How do we get into this war that doesn't seem to make any sense and that seems to be achieving the goals of no country? Well, maybe Israel, right? Maybe Israel. Although that may even be suspect. The reason for this war is money. Money and influence. This war is not, by any stretch of the imagination, about nukes. It's not about self-defense. It's certainly not about trying to help the Iranian people. That would be a joke, right? In fact, Iranians will tell you, 12 million of them just told us, right, who gathered in Tehran last week. You saw the pictures. They're basically saying to the United States, thanks, but no thanks. We don't need your help. In fact, what they seem to be saying is, leave us the hell alone. Stop bombing us, they said with placards, and much worse than that as well. So here's the real point in all this. This war in Iran, like most wars, they don't just happen. You know, it's not just like out of the blue one day a country decides to hit another country. It just doesn't happen that way. And the more you know about this, the more you'll understand. But by the way, the same thing that we're seeing with Iran, you could say the same thing about the war in Vietnam. You could say the same thing about the war in Iraq. You could say the same thing about the war in Libya or Syria or Ukraine. Every single one of them is carefully designed to benefit very few people. While the majority of us, in the case of me, for example, as an American, we get nothing in return for this war. In fact, it's a huge loss for all of us. So here's the question. What and who are the entities that create these wars? Who are those who actually gain from it? I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this in the last month or so. Yesterday, I asked the guy who wrote the leading book on this to join me on my live stream, because I wanted to drill down with him. And his book is called The $1 trillion War Machine. Great title, great book. The trillion, because that's what it is. It's worth like $1 trillion. Let's do this. I've decided I want to break this down for you. So me and the team decided to put something together so we can take you through the entities, right? This is how the sausage is made, right? So who gets the benefits of all of this, right? Who makes this happen? First, foremost, right on top. See them right there? The weapons makers. They're the ones who fund and influence, right? They make the stuff that needs to be used, because if it's not used, wars, they go out of business. They don't want to go out of business. They already control what? More than half of global arms sales worldwide. They control an estimated budget in the United States, a defense budget that they feed and then they draw from $2.3 trillion. Let me say that again, $2.3 trillion. That's crazy money. Of course they'll do anything for it. So who do they work with? Well, they work most closely with the political class. There they are in green, right? These are the people who work in government, but they need money to stay in office for the rest of their lives. They become millionaires in just a couple of years after getting a job that only pays $100,000 a year. These guys give them millions and millions of dollars. Why? So these guys will vote for expanding that $2.3 trillion military budget. And to make sure whenever there's a war coming, they vote for it. Yes, war in Iran, absolutely. War in Iraq, yes. They all stand up and say, aye. There might be one or two people who say no, right? Then you have the media. There they are, right? See, this is like a circle of influence, right? These are the people who make it happen. I used to be a part of these guys. I used to be there, right? This is Fox and CNN and all of these guys. These guys support these guys by having them on all the time and never asking them tough questions. Why do you think Lindsey Graham always lived and the rest of these guys? They were always right here, right? They're also billion-dollar companies. The companies that own CNN and Fox and the Disney Channel and the Cartoon Network and Paramount Pictures, all of them, they want wars. And they'll put it in their movies and their TV shows. They get ad money. How do they stay in business? They get money from these guys, the weapons makers. They literally send them money, right? Which makes no sense, because these guys make bombs and fighter jets. What the hell are they doing a commercial for fighter jets and bombs on CNN or the Cartoon Network? Who the hell's going to buy a bomb or a Cartoon Network watching this channel? See, but it's not about selling those things. It's about buying these companies' influence. And you know how else they do it? And I learned this when I worked there, when I worked at CNN. Sitting on the boards of these companies are people who are also on the boards of those companies that you see up there. Yeah, that's called interlocking. So they have the same people who are running that company are running this company. They make bombs, they make news. So what do you think the news is going to be about? That's called aligning their interests. That's how it works. It's crazy, but let me continue, because there's a new entity in all of this. This rich man's party that I'm telling you about has a new entry, right? These guys, the tech companies, right? So these are the companies like Palantir and all these other tech companies, right, that we hear about in that San Francisco area, right? They're not only profiting from wars by selling the software and the hardware, which are the new weapons of the world, right, with drone technology and everything, but they're also creating systems that violate America's right to privacy. So they're screwing Americans over two ways, right, by taking all of the money which is used for taxes, putting it in their pockets, and then they're also building data centers in America's backyards that are basically spying on Americans anyway, or will. And yes, they too also send money to the politicians, and they send money to the members of the media. In fact, many of the media companies are owned by these very same people. So you see how this works? They're all together. But there's one more. And this is the one that I have been spending a lot of time looking at lately. If you watched my show a lot, you've noticed I've been specializing in reports on Europe. And I noticed that this is happening in Europe a lot these days. So what am I talking about? The bankers. The bankers. The bankers are in on this big time, right? They're really called venture capitalists, because that's really what they are. They're investors. They're not regular bankers like where you and I might keep our money. These are investment bankers, right? And in recent years, some of the biggest hawks, the biggest pro-war names and companies have all become venture capitalists, right? I started noticing this. And by the way, they also fund the politicians and they also fund the media, right? I noticed this was taking off in Europe, where companies like BlackRock, for example, seem to own the politicians because, well, hell, they put them there. You know, a lot of these politicians work for BlackRock, and then one day they're prime minister of a country or the president of a country or a chancellor of a country, you know? Or they just, these guys have so much money, they can buy them. They can buy the politicians and put them there. Take the case, for example, of the German chancellor, Friedrich Merz. He seems to be more interested in serving BlackRock than taking care of his own people. So I told you about that book, right? Here is how Ben Freeman, who is the author of The $1 Trillion War Machine, explains who these venture capitalists or these VC guys are and exactly what it is that they do. Here's my conversation with Ben.
The best analogy for a VC guy is that they're gamblers. And some of them will even outright say that. You know, these guys are, they're making bets, though. You know, you call it gambling, call it whatever you want.
For these war. They're betting on war.
They're betting on war. Yeah, yeah. They're betting, you know, they might say that they are betting on firms who can help us win wars. But the key is, and this is something I should.
But they don't. But then if you don't get the war, what the hell? The bet's no good. So they're incentivized to, right?
And that's exactly it, Rick. And this is something I should have said right at the start, that you can't have a $1 trillion Pentagon budget without having wars to justify it, without having the threat of war to justify it.
It's a solution looking for a problem. They can't wait. They want to create a solution. Oh, shit, now we need a problem to be able to use a solution. Otherwise, we're going to go broke. So let's go convince everybody. We need the media. We need tech. We need this. We need that. And now let's go get Joe over here, who lives in Kansas, to go out there and tell all his neighbors that we got to attack whatever, the Bahamas tomorrow.
Right, right. It's all manufactured. And I mean, we have this great myth here that the U.S. government, it's looking out for your interests. You know, it's, you know, we're responding to the threats in the world. It's BS. We are creating the threats in the world to justify this corrupt system that takes all of our collective money and provides it to a select group of people, the insiders who are in on it.
Yeah, I tell you. Fascinating guy, fascinating book. If you want to hear this whole interview, by the way, it was really good. It's about 25 minutes, I think. It's on BitChute. Go. You can see it right there. Check it out. It was just posted within the last 24 hours. And again, it's the $1 trillion war machine. Joining us now with his weekly Eye on Europe segment is Chabos, another guy I find fascinating from time to time. Today in the news, don't laugh, Bulgaria. I would say Bulgaria has become the new home of the resistance. Who knew, right? What do you think, Che?
Yeah, very interesting, very interesting. Bulgaria, again, wouldn't have been that focal a point for the European project, has become a bit of a stone in the shoe, let's say, for Madame von der Leyen, okay? Now, check it out. This hasn't gone down very well in Ukraine. Check out this headline from Ukrainsky Pravda, or Ukrainian Truth, okay? It's a headline saying that the 21st sanctions package against Russia has failed. Okay, this one's from Kiev Independent, actually, okay? So they're not happy about this, and they're not happy for obvious reasons, because they're anxious that their sort of exceptionally intelligent spokesperson, Kaya Kallas, one of the smartest women you've ever come across, who's actually seems to be having an argument with a codfish the last time I seen her talking in the EU, quite remarkable woman, that this has been essentially blocked, and it's been blocked by, guess who? It's been blocked by the Bulgarians, essentially. Now, yeah, but this comes at a time when there's a realization in Europe, here in Europe, that these sanctions, like I think we're heading for the 14,000th sanction. The last batch, Rick, they actually sanctioned kids' summer camps in Crimea. I mean, it's getting to the point where if it wasn't so serious, it would be sort of comedic.
Yeah.
They're sanctioning very minor people and organizations like the dude who collects the pizza for a bank, you know, somewhere in Moscow. So he said, like, it's getting ridiculous, okay? But this has been defined by something that I spotted, which I just think is very funny. Check out this sort of meme that's circulating in Europe right now about how Europe has crippled itself with these sanctions against Russia. Because, of course, post-war, all of Germany, the dynamo of the industrial heartland of Europe, all of that came from Russian cheap energy, Russian gas, Russian oil. Check it out. So America is, you know, heading for Mars. The Chinese are, you know, basically doing the same. And all they can manage to do in Europe across the EU is this. Check this out. Is manage to attach your lid to your bottle of cola.
Oh.
To make it completely easy.
So,
you know, so that's it. So that's the kind of realization. Wait,
put that meme up again. So these are rockets that not only can go up into space, but they also can self-retract, right? They go back into the place from whence they came. And the Americans first figured it out. The Chinese, of course, beat them and, as you can see, have a better model, one that doesn't seem to be on fire. And the Europeans, they got a new bottle.
Yeah, the Europeans have got a new bottle. But it basically means you can't take the bottle off. So if you try to pour it, it goes everywhere. This is the single thing that Europeans are kind of saying, but, well, that's what we got, right?
But they're protecting but they're protecting the planet, dude. They're, you know, it's about not polluting, Che.
Look, everybody's for not polluting, but then they're also giving, you know, billions of dollars worth of drones to the Ukrainians to bomb the biggest gas and oil plants on Earth in Russia. No one's talking about the big
to destroy the planet, right? But yeah. You won't have plastic, but you also won't have the Black Sea or an ocean.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a huge. We keep talking about this reality on the streets here in Europe.
Right.
I can't seem to find anybody who think any of this stuff is a good idea. And talking about Bulgaria again. One of the key things that the Bulgarians refuse to do, because of their closeness to Russia in cultural sort of ways, they're the only other country in the world, really, that used the Cyrillic alphabet as well. They're in the EU, okay? Check it out. They refuse to sanction Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is held in huge esteem across Bulgaria, across Europe, in many, many post-Soviet countries. They refuse to do it. They basically say, we're not going to do this. We're not going to attack our own culture because of this sort of pseudo-cultural financial assault on Russia, which is failing. Okay.
The EU really wanted to sanction the patriarch? Yeah. After like their pope? Like go after a priest? Like you're sanctioned? You people aren't allowed to go talk to him, I guess? What? How do you sanction a priest?
Look, remember, they're also scared of dead poets. They're scared of anything Russian is dangerous. You know, Black Russian, anything you can do that has Russia in the title is lethal. They even stole borscht from the Russians and suddenly said it was Ukraine.
Can't eat borscht. Go to jail.
The guy is the focus now of all the heat that our friend Viktor Orban was getting. You remember Mr. Orban?
Of course.
He was blocking aid to Ukraine. He was preventing mass immigration into Europe. It seems someone else has stepped into his shoes, and that's this guy, Rumen Radev, okay? Who's the new prime minister, the new boss in Bulgaria. And he's just said, no, enough is enough. And, you know, he's also walked away from this coalition of the willing, you know? Now, I like to call it the coalition of the willing to buy lots of Russian gas before we get caught, because the coalition of the willing, the Europeans bought the whole production of the Yamal Russian gas plant, and then they banned Russian gas after buying billions of euros worth of it.
Oh, that's dirty pool. We hate the Russians, but hey,
away from this.
Yeah, that, like John F. Kennedy when he ordered a giant crate of cigars from Cuba before he put the embargo on Cuba. That's a famous story, by the way, and also true.
Exactly, exactly. So Radev has said, look, enough is enough. He's talking kind of like Babish in the Czech Republic and Fiso. He's saying, we need to talk democratically from the point of view of what our people elected us to do, which was in Bulgaria, certainly, to talk to the Russians, to get this war over, to sit down around the table, to do what will inevitably be done. Mm. There'll just be a lot less Ukraine to talk about. He's actually said that. Same as Fiso, same as Babiš in the Czech Republic. Mm. So it's kind of heartening to see that these warmongers, right, who are meeting in Paris today on Bastille Day to celebrate the liberty, equality, and fraternity, and have the Ukrainians marching at the front of how you can say that that's representing liberty, equality, and fraternity. That's another day's work.
Yeah.
But Radev has said, look, we want to talk to Russia. We're not going to ban their energy. We're not going to ban our own culture and religion for this crazy ideal.
And you could still be at odds with Russia.
You can still disagree with them. And he says, of course, we can disagree with them.
Right.
But one final thing about Radev, he used to be a test pilot. He's a fighter ace. He used to be a fighter pilot. And he was a fighter pilot on the Russian MiG-29 fighter jet, probably the best ever instructor of it. Very interesting guy. One to watch, Rick.
You're great, man. Hey, as usual, great segment. I learned from you, you know? And now you know about Cuban cigars being the best in the world and why JFK got a shipment of them before he announced the embargo on Cuba, similar to this. See, history repeats itself, doesn't it?
Another great Irishman, JFK.
That's right. And when you go to Ireland, they give you all kinds of exhibits of his visits there, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, by the way.
They're still talking about it.
Yeah, they are. Thanks, Che. Appreciate it, man. See you soon. So when we come back, speaking of it's okay to disagree with people, it's okay to disagree with Russia. That doesn't mean you have to hate them or want to punish them, but you can disagree with them. So speaking of disagreeing, I'm going to be joined by a guest who is in the United States. He says what the United States and what Donald Trump are doing or is doing is perfectly fine. In fact, he says it's needed. He's for the war in Iran. There's a very good possibility I might disagree with him and tell him so. By the way, before we go to the break, don't forget to catch us on the socials. We're on Spotify, X, YouTube, and of course, my new favorite, which is BitChute, where you can't be canceled, you can't be demonetized, and your content will never disappear. We will not disappear as well. We will be right back. And hello again, everybody. We're back. And once again, for this segment in the show, we've got some breaking news, or at least some new videos that are coming in from the conflagration that has been taking place. And it really is that right now, both sides firing at each other. We've got some video that was put up by CENTCOM a little while ago. And I think what you're going to see here is some of the areas that are being hit by the U.S. attacks. Most of this, as I understand it, at least according to some of the Reuters reporting that I've been looking over my shoulder at here, is coming in from Keshem Island, which is one of those islands which is right off the Strait of Hormuz. And there you see not only the impact, but you're actually watching some of the fighter jets as they're taking off for their missions. On the other side, there's also attacks that have been shared by Iranians as well. Iranians apparently have been continuing to hit Bahrain, and they've also been hitting Jordan. I mean, some of these pictures are amazing. It's almost like it almost seemed like for a while there, the situation was cooling down. It looked like there was a possibility of a ceasefire. That's certainly not the case right now. In fact, it looks now like both sides are doing their part to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed, which means it's really going to be a potential, at least economists say, it's a potential disaster for the world in terms of everything from fertilizer to chemicals to gas, all hydrocarbons, oil. If you can imagine that like 15% of the world's hydrocarbons and other important chemicals and cargo go through that area, and if it's shut down as it is right now, it's going to be causing real serious problems. And as you can see, just as you look at those pictures, you can only imagine how difficult it would be to do any kind of commerce in that stretch. So this is where we are. This is how the situation has gotten again. It looked like the war was off. Now the war is certainly back on. Captain Armin Kurdian is a retired U.S. Navy captain, engineer, and he's also a candidate right now for Congress. He served for 25 years in the Navy, so he's a military guy through and through. And he was also a veteran, served in Iraq, and he's good enough to join us now to take us through his thoughts about how this situation is developing. Captain, it's so nice of you to join us. You're so gracious to share your time with us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Morning, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, all the way from California. As a matter of fact, San Diego, we were just commenting before this that I think San Diego is one of the most beautiful cities in the United States. If you've never been there, no matter where you're watching us from around the world, you should check it out. All right, let's start with where we are right now. It looks like the Strait of Hormuz is now shut down. The president of the United States says, you know what? The Iranians were shutting it down. Now it's his turn to shut it down. He even mentioned today that he wants to charge vessels to go through, just like the Iranians were doing. What's your take on that?
Good morning. Well, it is truly unfortunate that commerce is actually shut down. I think some of this might be actually calculated on the Iranians' part. They say this is a rogue element of the IRGC regime that attacked those several commercial vessels, which really kind of instigated where we are right now. Mm-hmm. It might have been deliberate because they've always been kind of playing this game to try to test the political climate here in the United States, knowing they cannot stand up against the U.S. militarily, but hoping that they might win on the geopolitical stance in terms of what you talked about previously, in terms of the strangulation of commerce that's going through that area. So yeah, certainly that is going to be a challenge for global commerce. With regards to the charges and the tolls and everything, it's a little bit different, I think, on both sides. I think Iran is basically wanted to charge a protection racket for transiting through the Straits of Hormuz, saying, okay, you want to come through the Straits, through the international waters, this is going to cost you X amount of dollars. I think what the U.S. was proposing was actually charging for the actual escort, which I guess you could do that under international law. So if a U.S. vessel were to escort these ships coming through the Straits of Hormuz, something you could charge. It's not something I'd be necessarily necessarily in favor of. I don't think it sets a really good precedent there either. It's probably just probably bluster on the part of the president. But frankly, it's not just a U.S. problem. This is a global issue, and some of the other countries in the world actually need to probably take a little bit more notice and step up here.
But by international law, you're absolutely right. I looked a little while ago, and yes, countries that have waters, mostly their territorial waters, are allowed to charge fees. They're allowed to charge assessments. I mean, I guess that's been a long-standing tradition. What's difficult in this case is the Iranians, for the longest time, were helping to administrate the Strait of Hormuz, but they had never charged. They had never taken dominion of it. They had never really managed it, per se, until now. So it's hard not to look at this, Captain, and not say, my God, if we had just left the situation alone and if we hadn't attacked Iran, we wouldn't be dealing with this situation today. It's almost like we're trying to fix a problem we created.
Well, not necessarily. The entire goal was to stop Iran. Certainly, it's a fair question. The intent of the current conflict, obviously, was to stop Iran from building a nuclear weapon. They had the uranium to be able to do it. They had the technology for the delivery system. You know, they were developing the technology for a nuclear trigger, which is very, very challenging.
Yeah.
So if you remember going back to the first Trump administration, when we left the JCPOA, under the JCPOA, the Iranians basically had their sanctions lifted, and they got a lot of money back in. They were able to reconstitute themselves, their military, and also a lot of the militias throughout the rest of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was open source reporting, Shiite militias saying that golden times are over because the weapons weren't coming in. When the money comes in, they start reconstituting and they start rearming a lot of these militias.
Yeah, but they weren't building nuclear weapons. According to the 2025 U.S. intelligence assessment, this is not the Iranians. This is American intelligence saying the Iranians, quote unquote, are not building nuclear weapons. The International Atomic Energy Agency, quote, we have a watertight inspection system in place. The Iranians are not building nuclear weapons. There is nothing that I have found that would show me that the Iranians were building nuclear weapons, except what Bibi Netanyahu wanted us to think.
Yeah, the physical construction of an actual bomb, no, they had not been doing it, but they had been continuing to pull together the technology to actually do that, something that they were not supposed to be doing. And this is simply not something that we could even accept a 1% or 2% threat of the Iranian regime building a nuclear weapon in secret, whether the IAEA knew about it or not. It is simply a black and white scenario of a regime of that nature having a nuclear weapon. If they had the uranium to actually do that, to build 10, 11 nuclear bombs and build that technology, it was a great danger to the rest of the world,
but
the U.S. and the West. And it's simply not part of the global calculus that this is something that could be allowed to do so.
But you'll pardon me for doing this, but I'm so sorry. I've heard that same story that you just shared with me during Iraq. We heard it during Syria. We heard it during Libya. There's always some guy in America telling us that we're going to be attacked by some country and we have to go to war. Meanwhile, we get nothing as Americans for ourselves. Our communities are never better off. And I haven't seen one shred of evidence that Iran at any time had threatened or had attacked the United States. As a matter of fact, I looked it up. Iran has never attacked kinetically the United States of America. Sure, there have been some attacks between proxies in the Middle East and attacking Israel, and then our troops got involved. And of course, that's a terrible thing. But on the converse, 2025, the 12-day war, we attacked Iran. 2020, we assassinated Soleimani. 1987, Operation Nimble Archer, we attacked Iran. 1988, Operation Praying Mantis, we attacked Iran. 1988, we shot down an Iranian airliner, never even apologized for it. So, you know, to make the case that Iran was dangerous to us, it looks to me, if you look at history, like we were more dangerous to them. We've attacked them 5 or 6 times. They haven't attacked us.
Well, all the attacks have been in response to what you say, a lot of the indirect asymmetric attacks against the United States. You know, take Praying Mantis, for example. In 1988, Iran had continued to attack neutral shipping. They've been shooting at ships. We caught them mining the Gulf, which was also a violation of international law. We captured one of their frigates that was actually doing that.
Fair point.
And then we punished them for it. During OIF, whether or not we agree with the premise of that particular war. Iran decided to get involved and was arming a lot of the Shiite militias, giving them IEDs, those highly technical weapons that built to defend or defeat U.S. armor and killed and maimed, you know, thousands of U.S. soldiers for no other reason than just harming Americans. So certainly Iran has caused a lot of damage to the U.S., caused a lot of damage to U.S. Interests and also to the global economy in that sense.
But you know,
remember the Iranian people. I mean, my mother was actually born there. My mother was actually born in Iran. And, you know, it's a beautiful and it's a wonderful country. The Persian people have a wonderful, terrific culture. They're simply under the thumb of this miserable religious theocracy that has just been an anathema and pariah to the world as a whole for the last 47 years.
Has it really for the world or just for Israel? Because it sounds like what you're saying is Iran has been bad because the United States and Israel. But looking at it from the point of view of other countries in the world, right now, Iran is seen as almost a heroic country. They've taken on the biggest, baddest military in the world. And most military analysts that I talk to say that they're actually winning, if not kinetically, certainly geopolitically. And after all, they didn't attack. They were attacked. So I'm not sure it's fair to say that Iran is a country that has been seen by the rest of the world as a rogue state. I think, and as a matter of fact, right now it may be completely the opposite. If you look at the Global South countries, if you look at most of the countries, for example, in BRICS, which I know is different than what you see when you watch Fox News at night, it's just the opposite. Iran might right now be one of the most admired countries in the world. That must be weird for me to, for you to hear me say that, right?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I'm sure a lot of the countries in the Middle East, a lot of the countries in the Arab League would not agree with that assessment. I'm sure a lot of the countries in Europe would not agree with that assessment, as a lot of Islamic fundamentalism has been exported to those countries as well. And they're dealing with a lot of issues on the immigration side, too. So I would not say that that's an accurate statement.
I would bet you if you did a poll in most Middle Eastern countries, you would find that like 90% of the people, not these guys in the white robes who are the leaders of some of these, for example, Gulf states, who are all trillionaires. I'm talking about the people. They admire Iran for what it's done and for standing up for the rights of Palestinians and for standing up for the rights of people in Lebanon who are being bombed as we speak by Israel. That's a fact.
Well, I'm sure the Saudis would disagree with that. I mean, Iran attacked a Saudi oil facility.
Yeah.
Unprovoked as well. They attacked them. There was no reason for them to do that. They have been funding the Houthi rebels who have been a thorn in the side of Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the other Arab states for quite some time. Also attacking a lot of neutral shipping at the same time. So this has been also a major problem. The Shiite militias that had safe harbor in Syria under the Assad regime have caused havoc throughout the Middle East as well. And of course, we all know about October 7th and what Hezbollah has been doing to the poor Lebanese people and to Israel for a long period of time. Just imagine if all of this money that Iran had been funding into the Middle East, into these terrorist organizations, into these militias, had instead, if they really care about the Palestinians so much, if instead it had been funded into infrastructure and hospitals and, say, you know, tourist attractions and economic development, then we wouldn't be having these kinds of problems right now.
We couldn't.
So, but instead they wanted to give them rockets and suicide vests.
But they can't do
this
that.
This is where we are.
But the point you is, it's a fallacious argument that you just raised, Captain, because you can't do that when you are one of the most sanctioned, one of the most economically punished countries in the history of the world, which is what we've been doing to them. And unfortunately, we do that all over the world. We go into countries, we literally sanction them, freeze their assets, destroy their economies, hurt their currency, and then we point at them and say, oh, look, these guys are horrible. They don't know how to run an economy. They don't know how to run an economy because a hegemonic state has done everything possible to destroy their economy. And that's exactly what we did in Iran, and that's exactly what we did in Iraq, in a place where you served, which was also a military disaster, by the way.
Yeah, let's remember that hegemonic state was also funding that behind the bombing of the Beirut, the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1982, the U.S. Embassy, and the multiple other bombings. So I would disagree with that assessment, quite frankly. Iran chose to be an enemy of the United States when they had their Islamic Revolution in 1979. Certainly the Shah's regime was not a what one would call a free society either,
yeah.
But it was certainly much better than where they were right now.
But I got to check you on that. I'm so sorry for this, but you just said when they had their Islamic revolution, you mean when they elected a democratic new prime minister? Because Mossadegh was democratically elected, and we decided to take him out because he was going to challenge the oil hierarchy that we had set up. I mean, that's just a fact. We took him out because we wanted to control their oil. We didn't want them to control the oil. And when he mentioned that he wanted to do that, the CIA and the MI6 went out there and essentially took the guy out. That's a fact. Everybody in the world knows that.
Wanted to get a lot closer to the Soviet Union. He wanted to nationalize the oil industry as well. You know, certainly if you want to go back to, 100 years ago to the Anglo-Iranian oil company of yore, that was maybe one example of perhaps you want to talk about hegemony, how the Europeans treated a lot of different parts of the world. And yeah. I think you've got some valid points there in terms of the English or the West maybe paying the Iranians, a fraction of what the oil was worth on the oil on the global market. So certainly
yeah.
a lot of those things did happen. But we're talking about more modern times and where we are today. Iran had several decades to grow, be a international partner, be a part of the international community at the same time. It was a great country. I was there in 1975.
Yeah.
You had Elvis Presley on the radio. You had Keebler crackers for sale, Sesame Street on TV, women wearing makeup and shorts. It's a beautiful country, a very metropolitan international city. Tehran is beautiful. Unfortunately, what's happened since then, the religious fanatics have made this choice that they want to be an enemy of the U.S. They want to be an enemy of Israel. Had they not done that, we wouldn't be in the situation that we are today.
I can understand why they might want to be enemies of the United States and enemies of Israel, given how Israel in particular has treated them. By the way, I was in Iran not long ago, and I also saw women wearing makeup and with their hair down and wearing very short, tight shorts. Just about everywhere I went. I also saw mullahs, and I also saw women completely covered from head to toe. So it pretty much runs the gamut, but it's not the stories you watch on American movies, nor is it what you watch on Fox News, that they're all terrorists, bloodthirsty, with knives going around killing women just for showing a little bit of their hair or a little bit of their face. Completely not true. So, it's all about context, right? It's about trying to understand people than instead of just... turning them all into villains, which is, I think, what we do too often. We did it with Iraq. We do it with Syria. We do it with the Middle East. It's like the Israelis have convinced us all that all Muslims are bad and they're all terrorists, and then we've just kind of gone along with it. And we just can't continue to go around having wars with everybody. We've got to come up with... You're running for Congress. You're going to represent the people of San Diego. How do we make their lives better? It's not by going to war with Iran. Just isn't, right? Or am I crazy?
Well, if Iran is truly a free society the way you picture it, they wouldn't have killed thousands of their protesters in the streets who are trying to get a better life and do something better. So that's a very recent example of what Iran has done to basically show that they are not a free society, that they are not someone that recognizes and respects human rights in their part of the world. The fact that that even over the last couple of decades, I can't remember when it was, when they were put in charge of the UN's Human Rights Commission was a little bit of a joke. When it comes to wars, someone who has served in the military, I can tell you that I'm not in favor of forever wars, and that the use of the U.S. military and the use of force needs to be quick, it needs to be fast, it needs to be deliberate, it needs to be intentional in terms of what you're actually doing when you have mission creep. And this is true throughout millennia of military history.
Has this war been that? Because it seems like a complete catastrophe to me, looking at it from a geopolitical standpoint. Everything you just said is the opposite of the way this war has so far been executed.
No, not necessarily. During Epic Fury, targeting was, for the most part, and properly constrained to the military facilities, the infrastructure that built drones, the infrastructure and the factories that built rockets, the port facilities. When there was, you know, when Israel attacked the refinery there in Iran, I think the president rightfully told Israel, hey, you can't do that. Mm. That's completely unnecessary. You don't need to destroy oil infrastructure because that really hurts the civilian population. Or going after bridges or power plants is also something that we don't want to be doing in that kind of a conflict. And I think for the most part, we have constrained ourselves. And I've been very publicly stated that that kind of targeting would not be appropriate. So far, you know, attacks against the also surface-to-air missile sites and radar sites, their ability to influence issues throughout the Straits of Hormuz or attack commercial shipping has been proper. And a lot of the smaller islands, you mentioned Ketchum, yes. Abu Musa, the greater yes. and lesser tombs, not necessarily Karg Island. Karg Island is their oil terminal where a lot of their oil comes out. It's not necessarily a military facility. A lot of those islands there in the Straits of Hormuz, from which a lot of these attacks have been launched. It is a little bit of a tit for tat right now, and it could seem on the surface what you're saying is a little bit of a forever war, but I don't believe that the president wants it. I don't think the U.S. military wants to do it either.
Here's the problem. I don't think it's possible for the United States to win this war with Iran for the simple purpose that Iran still has, according to the last report, according to the military assessment I just saw, anywhere between 60 and 70% of its missiles still available. It still has a geography that's very, very difficult to penetrate because of the mountains up against the cliffs, which basically oversee what is the Persian Gulf, and they, after all, are, like you, Persians, at least by blood. So they have the military, the geographical advantage, and because of what military experts are saying, our missile defense systems, like the Patriot, have just not held up. I've talked to experts who've said the Patriot system has knocked out like 5% of what Iran's have shot into these Persian Gulf countries like, Oman and Qatar and stuff. That's a miserable rate. Like, what happened?
Actually not correct. Patriot missiles have had a very high success rate against the incoming ballistic missiles. A lot of drones that have been that have come in have also been shot down. Obviously, there's a lot of them. Some of them do get through. But there's also a little bit of a triage. If it looks like a drone is going into an area where it's not going to be effective, or it's going to miss its target, or simply going out into open terrain, they just sort of let it go. So the success rate has certainly been a lot higher. Now, having said that, it's been the genesis. Actually, if you go back to the genesis of the Ukraine-Russia war, which has really kind of changed the face of warfare a lot, it's really been the hallmark of the introduction of a lot of these drone warfare. It's, for all practical purposes, it's the return of the German V1 buzz bomb in mass quantities. So you see us now also building a lot of one-way attack drones. It's been the great equalizer for Ukraine at the same time. So the Western nations, everybody is adapting to this change in warfare. Certainly we've been a lot more effective than just knocking down 5% of the incoming drones and missiles.
It may be more than 5%, but it hasn't been a pretty picture. And I could show you videos right now of what, to this day, the Iranians are able to do in Jordan and in Qatar and in UAE. And it's bad. They have devastated these U.S. Military facilities. Let's end with this, because I'm wondering, one of the things that I, as an American, am bothered by is the fact that too many people are elected to Congress, and when they get there, they're beholden to everybody but the people that they're supposed to represent. I mean, I can tell you right now, you know what the people of Israel, for example, who have a ton of our money, they have maternity leave for women. They have incredible universal health care for all citizens, not just old guys like me after we turn 65. They have mandatory overtime pay for people who work. You know, at least they get a couple of. We don't have any of that stuff in our country, but boy, we sure do spend a lot of money on wars, and we sure do have more $1 trillion defense budget. My concern is not you, because you seem like a really honorable man, But so many people get to Congress, and as soon as they get there, their hand is out, and between the money from Israel and the money from big tech and the money from the military contractors, why the hell should I help the people of San Diego when I can spend the rest of my life in this cush job, walk away like a Mitch McConnell with $37 million, and make sure I took care of all the donors? And this is what Americans are complaining about, that our politicians seem to all be on the take. How are you going to be different?
Well, let's put it this way. When it comes to, you know, being on the take or being influenced by a lot of money, you know, if I get elected to Congress, if I'm so honored to be chosen by the people here in this county to go there, now I'll be 56 years old and I don't have a lot of time, so to speak, to allow myself to be corrupted, if you will. It's never been something that I've been able to do. It's just not in my nature. Throughout my time in the Navy, I actually had to go against the grain several times to do what I believed was right. And, you know, sometimes I got my way and sometimes I didn't get my way. When it comes to, you know, spending the defense budget and our healthcare system, we do a great job of spending money in Congress, a really, really good job of spending money in Congress. The problem is we're not accountable to the process. We're not accountable to actually solving the problem. You know, our current congressman's answer for any problem that he sees, whether it's veterans care or healthcare, whatever, let's throw more money at it and make the problem go away. I found out that during my time in the Navy, sometimes when you throw more money at a problem, it actually makes it worse. So, you know, we got to do a much better job of managing funds and managing money in Congress. We got to make hard choices. And certainly, to your point, a lot of folks who are elected in Congress, they just don't want to do that. They just want to get the money out. And it's all about running for reelection on a continuous basis.
Yep.
That's just not who I am. And it's been the hallmark of my campaign. It's like, I'm going to go and get elected and do the right thing, you know, whether or not it's politically advantageous to do so. And you find a lot of times when you make those bold stances, when you actually go out and do the right thing, the electorate actually rewards you. And when you try to play both sides, you know, try to be everybody's friend, the American public, the American voters are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, and they will hold you accountable for that.
You seem like an honest man. You seem like a man with really good intentions and someone who wants to go out there and try and get the job done. And boy, do we ever need change, at least with our elected officials. It just seems, looking at it from the outside more than ever now, like too many of the people in Congress and too many of the people in the Senate and too many of the people, even at the elected levels, at the state level, are just doing everything possible to make lives better for themselves and their friends, and not necessarily for the people of America, not for my wife, Suzanne, not for my kids, not for my sons, you know. And that's what we ought to change. We ought to make it better for the people. And I trust that you, being the kind of man with the kind of record that you have, will do just that. You're so nice to, and so gracious to spend time with us and share your perspectives on all of this, even in the areas where we disagree, because that's what, you know, America's all about. So thanks again for taking time to talk to us.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
We appreciate your time, Captain. Thank you very much. And that's it for us. It's an interesting conversation to be able to talk to someone like that. I could have talked to him for a lot longer, but we had a, you know, requested period of time which we were going to spend. And you can hear, can't you, in many of his answers, that he is a product of the lexicon that stems from Western media. He is a Republican, after all, and he's a man who's, like he said, 56 years old, and he's right there in that wheelhouse, which means he's probably watching Fox News. He's probably thinking in terms, as you heard, that are pro-war. He tried to put it in perspective, and he was respectful of my perspective on this war, which is obviously very different from his. But it's important to have these conversations. It's also important to understand why people come from where they come from, which is, you know, the case with Captain Kurdion. It's important to do this, though. It's important that we have these discussions. It's important that we disagree, and we're going to continue doing it. I'm Rick Sanchez. It's so great to be with you, and for all you have to say as well. You know, if you catch this segment later on as well and you see it on one of the socials, whether it's YouTube or BitChute or Spotify, let us know what you think. Let us know. If you disagree with Captain or if you disagree with me, let me know. I'd love to know. It makes us better in the end. And most of all, as usual, thanks so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.